Good morning. I have 9 o'clock on my watch, a little after. Time to start. We are just finishing up chapter 2, about to start chapter 3 of Daniel. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this beautiful day. We're thankful for this opportunity we have to come and study your word, to worship you. Father, we pray that as we study this wonderful book of Daniel that you've given us, that we will understand what your message is in that book for us, Father, and we'll see your hand in operation as you carry out your plan of redemption and bringing Jesus into this world and establishing your eternal kingdom. And Father, our prayer is that as we live our lives, we will look for those moments in which we can stand up and be counted in this world, and we can let the world know whose side we are on. And our prayer is that when those times come, that we will not compromise, but we will stand faithful and true with you, and that all the world will know that. And Father, we pray all of these things in the name of our King, Jesus Christ. Amen. We were going to start today by looking at some questions regarding chapter 2, and I'll ask you in a moment if you have any additional questions, but we do have one question to start with. And let me remind everyone that all the audio from these lessons, as well as any handouts we have, is available on the internet at studydaniel.com. And one of the things on studydaniel.com that you can use is a little box to type in any questions you may have, and they will get emailed to me, or of course you can ask them at any time. One of the questions that came up from last week was involved the idea of a restored kingdom. I'd made the point that the eternal kingdom established in Acts 2 was, in some sense, a restored kingdom. And as I said, there's certainly much about that eternal kingdom that's new. Jesus told us many things about it that are new. But there's one aspect of that eternal kingdom that is not new, and that is that Jesus did not get a new throne. Instead, Jesus reigns from the throne of David under the unconditional Davidic covenant of Psalm 89. And the Bible speaks of that reign as a restoration of the Davidic throne. Acts 15, 15 through 17, for example. Acts 15. And to this agree the words of the prophets, as it is written. After this I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David, which is fallen down. I will build again the ruins thereof. I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord and all the Gentiles. Now, those verses are speaking about the church, and particularly they're speaking about the unity of Gentile and Jew in the church. But notice the language of verse 16 there in Acts 15. I will build again. I will build again the ruins. I will set it up. It had fallen down. That's language of restoration. That's not language of creating something new. Well, what is that thing? What was built up? What was restored? And the Bible tells us that also in those same verses. It's the throne of David, called the tabernacle of David there. Luke 1:32 tells us the same thing. Luke 1:32, the Lord shall give unto him, Jesus, the throne of his father David. So again, Jesus got the throne of his father David, which comes from Psalm 89, the Davidic covenant. Now, when I said the eternal kingdom is a restored kingdom, that's all I meant by that statement. It's just another way of looking at the kingdom. You know, when Jesus told us about the kingdom in the parables, he would often look at the kingdom from different angles. You know, in this direction it looks like a mustard seed, in this direction it looks like a pearl or something. And so this is another way to look at the kingdom. Now there's a whole other way to approach this problem, this issue. Let's look at that a second. Go over to Acts chapter 1, verse 6. We spent a lot of time looking at verse 6. Last time what we did was we started by looking at the Old Testament to see that there is a sense in which the kingdom was restored. And then we ended at verse 6 of Acts chapter 1 and said, well, there you go. He talks about the restored kingdom. Let's look at that problem directly opposite. Let's start with Acts chapter 1, verse 6 and see where that leads us. Let's start with verse 6 of Acts chapter 1. Look, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? That's the question in Acts chapter 1, verse 6. Notice the question actually uses the word restore. Now, when you get to chapter 1 of Acts, verse 6, you're faced with a threshold question right at the very start. Is that a good question or is that a bad question? Did the apostles ask a good question or did the apostles ask a bad question? Now, I've mentioned several times that I think it's a good question. I think the evidence suggests it's a good question. The apostles had their minds opened in Luke 24:45 to understand the scriptures. In Acts 1:3, Jesus had spoken to them for 40 days pertaining to the kingdom. Jesus' answer in Acts 1:7-8 gives no indication the apostles were wrong, only that it wasn't yet for them to know the time when this would happen. And as we've already seen, there is a sense in which the kingdom was restored. And in fact, Peter, in the very next chapter, Acts chapter 2, will mention the throne of David. So, if Acts chapter 1 verse 6 is a good question, what can we learn from it? They had just spent 40 days talking to Jesus about the kingdom. They come out of that and ask a question. That question could be very important to us because it's going to tell us something that Jesus talked to them about. There's some topic that Jesus had talked to them about the kingdom, and now they have a question. So I think we can learn something from this question. For starters, we can infer from it what Jesus talked to them about, and most likely Jesus was talking to them about some sense in which the kingdom was restored. Because they come out of that thinking, okay, when will it be restored? That's their question. Not if, but when will it be restored? So if verse 6 is a good question, then we know there's some sense in which the kingdom was restored. Well, what had Israel lost? Look at verse 6 again. It's not just restored, period. It's restored to Israel. It's restored to the kingdom of Israel. What had the kingdom of Israel lost? What needed to be restored? The throne of David. There had not been anyone ruling from the throne of David since, what, Zedekiah? It had been hundreds of years no one had been ruling from the throne of David. That needed to be restored, Psalm 89. That was an unconditional promise. That's what needed to be restored. And in fact, that happened in the very next chapter, Acts chapter 2. And that's what Jesus told them in Acts 24:49. And I think it's also what he told them here in verse 8 of Acts chapter 1. That it's going to happen when you receive the power, which is what happened in the very next chapter in Acts chapter 2. Let me stop then and ask if there are any other questions on chapter 2 or any other questions on the kingdom. Again, if there are any, please let me know or type them in that little box and we'll back up and talk about them. But let's move on to chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. This is one we've been studying since we were in BBS, I imagine. It's a very popular chapter with regard to some very big heroes of the faith that we meet in chapter 3. In this chapter, we're going to discover what it means to take a stand for God, what it means when you refuse to compromise with the gods of this world. And boy, that's a message we all need today. We're going to meet three young men, I think still quite young, who were truly profiles in courage. Two of the central themes in the book of Daniel that we're going to see in every chapter are, one, the absolute sovereignty of God, and two, the love of God for his people. You could think of these really as one theme, and that is the loving king. God is the loving king. Now, when we get to the apocalyptic sections of Daniel, that's when we're going to see all the wild language that's describing in kind of visual terms the various visions and things. They're going to be showing these same two attributes of God, the absolute sovereignty of God and the power of God and the love of God. What we're seeing here in this chapter, as well as what we'll see in chapters 5 and 6, and what we've already seen in chapter 2, are historical demonstrations of those themes, the sovereignty of God, the love of God. So we're seeing them from various different approaches and angles. But, of course, what we're reading in chapter 3, that's history. These are historical demonstrations of those themes. Now, as with Revelation, the book of Daniel has a goal, and that is to provide assurance and comfort to God's people. God is telling his people that despite what they may be seeing, they had not been forgotten. God had not forgotten them, but God still knew them. He still loved them. God still had a plan for them. So all was well, despite how it may have looked to them. That's a message of Revelation. That's a message of Daniel. We have to see both books in that context. Now, in chapter 2, what we just finished, God made known his great wisdom in revealing the king's dream. Here in chapter 3, God is going to show the same king his great power, God's great power. Also, overarching themes of Daniel, the wisdom of God, the power of God. In spite of present appearances, God is in control. That's a message of Daniel. God, all-powerful, all-wise, God is in control, despite how things may have looked. And, of course, that's a very good lesson for all of us to recognize that God an all-powerful, all-loving, all-wise God is still in control. Daniel 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 70 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Well, the king makes a giant golden image and he sets it up before all the people. Now, Daniel does not tell us whether this image was of the king himself, which is a possibility, or of one of the king's false gods, Marduk, for example, which is also a possibility. The commentators differ on that question. Some even suggest it may not have been an image of a person or at all. It may have been just an obelisk or something. The gold, though, on this statue, it's a statue of gold. Where have we seen that before? We just saw that in chapter 2. The gold on this statue seems to be linking it to the gold we just saw in the image in chapter 2. And that may be a clue that this statue was indeed of the king himself. Although historians tell us that the Mesopotamian rulers rarely depicted themselves in this way as divine, but that doesn't mean Nebuchadnezzar didn't do that. He went against the trend on numerous occasions. Although perhaps if he had made this up himself, it might make you wonder, well, why didn't he just ask them to fall down and worship himself? I mean, he was standing there in person. So maybe it was of Nebuchadnezzar's false god, Marduk, for example. Notice that it did not take Nebuchadnezzar very long to cast aside all of the newly found religious insights he experienced at the end of chapter 2. That was just a few verses ago that he was proclaiming to Daniel, your God is the God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now you can see just a few verses later he's building this giant image. But of course, Nebuchadnezzar was a polytheist. He believed there were many gods. And I'm sure he thought the Jews should also be capable of having multiple loyalties to many different gods. The Babylonians' polytheism is very strange to us. It's hard for us to understand that. But the Jewish monotheism was just as strange to the Babylonians. They couldn't wrap their brain around that. The idea of one true God, that's not something the Babylonians could understand. When men create a religion, they create many gods, don't they? We see it over and over throughout history. The Jews, though, worshipped one God. And that is such a strong indication that that religion did not come from man, that that was revealed to man. It was received by man. Because when we see men creating religions, we see multiple gods. But not so with the one true God. If Israel had dreamed up their religion, then they, like all their neighbors, would have had many gods. But they did not dream up their religion. They received that through revelation from the one true God. Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. That verse was revolutionary. It's a revolutionary concept at that time. Unheard of in the ancient world. And you then fast forward to Ephesians 4, the chapter of ones, and you see how important that revolutionary verse is to us as well. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, one Father of all. So that is a revolutionary concept, although, you know, we've grown very accustomed to it. But at the time, it was very different from all that surrounded it. There is one God, and we need to stop, I think, perhaps, and reflect on that more often, the importance of that. And the only reason we know there is only one God is because that one true God has revealed himself to us. Now, the similarity between this image in chapter 3 and the one in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, to me, seems to be more than a coincidence. They're very closely linked in the text and very closely linked in their description. Recall in the earlier image that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. So, in fact, if this image is of the king himself, then it looks like he was not satisfied with just being the head of gold. He wanted to be the whole image of gold. And he may have been thinking about that and decided, well, I think I'll just show everybody that the whole thing is gold. The whole thing is me. That seems very likely to me. Apparently, all that Nebuchadnezzar now remembered from chapter 2 was the statement that you are the head of gold. So I guess we all have our favorite verses. That must have been his. And it may be that Daniel is now saying to God, okay, God of Daniel, You say, I'm the statue? Here I am. Here's the statue. Where's your rock? Where's this big stone you told me about? I've set up the statue now. God, you bring the rock on. That may have been what he's doing. He may be kind of making a challenge to God here. Well, it's going to be answered. Nebuchadnezzar's plan was really a very common one. We see it repeated. He was planning on boosting his own political power through this the use of religion. And we see that not only here, we see that elsewhere in this book, and we also see it from history. When you look at the Babylonian Chronicles that we've talked about a little bit, of course we see that all the time today too, politicians running for office, espousing various religious views that are quickly forgotten once they get that which they sought. A characteristic of idolatry is that the idol serves the worshiper and serves the worshiper's aims, as opposed to vice versa. And I think we're seeing that here with this giant golden image. How large was this image? Well, 60 cubits tall, 6 cubits wide. At 18 inches a cubit, that's 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. The date palm trees that grew all over that area, they were about 90 feet tall, very tall trees, and they were almost as slender as this. 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide, that is looking more like an obelisk than a traditional statue we think of a person. It's about the size of a 9-story building, but only 9 feet wide. So very narrow, very tall, almost like a totem pole looking thing. Why 60 by 6? Well, we've already mentioned the Babylonian number system, base 60, unlike our own base 10. When you study Revelation, you'll find that 6 has a very symbolic meaning. 7 is the number of perfection. 6 is falling short of perfection, hopelessly short of the beautiful number 7. So when it comes time to depict Rome by a number, what does God choose? Not 777, perfection times 3, 3 the number of God, the Godhead, but 666. Six, falling hopelessly short. Now, this number, though, is not only symbolic because it's also a real number. It was actually 60 by 6. So this is a historical number. But I think there is a bit of a symbolic link here with what we'll find later in Revelation. Now, liberal critics, they always find something to harp about. And when they get here, they say, look, who would build a statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide? It's just preposterous, they say. It's just so tall. No one would build this, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Colossus at Rhodes was taller, so we know they would build things this tall, and others did. Also, this image may have been on a big pedestal. If it was of a person, and it was 90 feet tall and only 9 feet wide, it was probably on a big pedestal that came up and then had the statue on top of the pedestal. And in fact, an archaeologist has found evidence of a big pedestal very close to where this may have very well been located. A French archaeologist, Aupert, located the remains of a brick structure, 45 feet square, 20 feet high, 12 miles southeast of Hilla, which is about 4 miles south of ancient Babylon. And this French archaeologist believes that, in fact, is the base of the statue that we're reading about here in chapter 3. Now, liberal critics also say, look, there wouldn't have been enough gold in all the land to build something this tall, all made of solid gold. Where does it say it was solid gold? Right. I mean, it was very likely gold-plated, which is how they built statues at the time. Look at Isaiah 40, verse 19. The idol, a workman cast it, and the goldsmith overlays it with gold. So that's very likely what we have here as well, gold-plated. What is the religious significance of this image to Nebuchadnezzar? Well, in fact, when we answer that question, we're going to get another piece of evidence as to when this book was written. It has a very early date, and we can see that here also. Archaeological discoveries have shown us that Nebuchadnezzar had building projects in this area, that they extended beyond the city. So we know that. Dura means a walled place. This is very likely in a suburb of Babylon, pretty close, but out in the country a ways. If this base that Aupert found is in fact the statue, then it's about 4 miles away from ancient Babylon. History now tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was a religious reformer. for the Babylonian religion. Apparently, before Nebuchadnezzar, there were all these secret rites, and the people could not participate in them, but only the high priesthood of the false god could go in and participate. And historians now tell us that Nebuchadnezzar changed that, that he removed all that secrecy, and instead he had public worship by all the people. Well, why? Well, we've already mentioned probably the most likely reason, and that is that Nebuchadnezzar was insecure on his throne, and he wanted to use religion as a unifying force. We see that later with Rome in Revelation, first with Caesar worship. They used that to unify the people. And later, under Constantine, he will later kind of take over Christianity to also use it as a unifying force. That's what Nebuchadnezzar's doing right here. Let me ask this question. If Daniel had been written 400 years after the fact, not under Babylonian rule, not under Persian rule, but under Greek rule, by some Jew living in Palestine, how would that person have known about the religious reforms of Nebuchadnezzar 400 years earlier? Daniel knew about it because Daniel was there and he saw it and he witnessed it. That's more evidence as to when this book was written. Verse 2. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, and the captains, and the judges, and the treasurers, and the counselors, and the sheriffs, all the rulers of the province were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You have to love how this is written. I mean, we of course all know it's inspired, but it was also there's a wonderful literary hand here at work. Why repeat that list twice like that? Two verses. Why repeat that list? It's because it's building up. It's like everybody's doing this. Look at all the people. It's the sheriffs. It's the judges. It's the treasurers. It's the council. I mean, over and over and over. Who could possibly not join in with this crowd? Right? I mean, that's where we're headed here. Everybody's doing this. All the important people are involved. That's why it's repeated twice. Beautiful, beautiful, the way that's done. From Nebuchadnezzar's viewpoint, from the great King Nebuchadnezzar's viewpoint, it is inconceivable that anybody would refuse this simple demonstration of loyalty to the king and to Babylon. He couldn't wrap his mind around it. How could anybody not do this? And, of course, we experience the same incredulity today, don't we? Same kind of attitude. You're opposed to gay marriage? What's wrong with you? You don't believe in evolution? What, flat earth society? It's just the same kind of shock. And, honestly, I think they're probably genuinely shocked, right? I mean, I think they are. I've talked to some of them, and it's like they're just... their mouth hangs open. They just can't believe it. They cannot believe it. And as our society descends into the abyss, we're going to find ourselves increasingly different. Or we better find ourselves increasingly different. And I think we're going to see more of that shock. That's going to be Nebuchadnezzar's reaction. He's not going to be able to believe it. Again, look at the list of titles there in verse 2. I went through them all. The Revised Standard Version has a different list of translation, rather. It has the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, etc. These titles point to a very well-organized bureaucracy. Everybody has their own little title. And, you know, I could go through the list here and kind of tell you what they all mean, but I think you can see here what they mean. A governor or captain, we see that in Malachi 1:8. Judea was administered by such a person. Each area had such a person. So there's a very detailed bureaucracy of people working here. Five of these terms are Persian terms. Now that could be seen as a problem. Why? Because we're living under Babylon at this point in chapter 3. The Persian rule will not start for another 70 years. That's later. That's when Daniel gets tossed in the lion's den. Daniel's still very young here. He gets tossed in the lion's den when he's like 80 or something. So that's later. So why do we have these Persian terms in chapter 3? Couple of possibilities. The one that I favor is that even though this happened much earlier, it was written down under Persian rule. When the book was written, that was much later in Daniel's life. So what he may have done then is kind of substitute the current terms for the terms that were used 70 years ago. Another possibility is that these were actual terms that were used under Babylonian rule, and that the Persian titles had kind of come into use by the Chaldeans. That's also a possibility. But here's an important point. The use of these particular Persian terms points to an early date for this book, an early date for this book. Why? Because by the time of the 2nd century BC, when the liberal critics tell us this book was written, these terms had already become obsolete. And in fact, when they were translated by the Alexandrian Jews, they were mistranslated. They'd forgotten what they meant. Well, if that's the case, how could this have been written at that time? This was written back when it says it was written by Daniel in the much, much earlier than the 2nd century BC. And this is additional evidence of that. Verse 4. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall be the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." Again, from the literary perspective, you notice he's listing the list twice, too. You got all the people listed twice, all the different kinds of music he listed twice. I mean, it's just a steamroll. It's coming straight to a point. Who could possibly not participate in this is kind of where it's leading us. Well, we're about to find out who wouldn't do that. There's also a bit of a satirical effect that we see here. Here are all the great ones of the empire falling flat on their face before this lifeless image when Nebuchadnezzar waves his baton. I mean, it's almost humorous as you picture it in your mind how it must have looked. Notice it says here that all the people of every nation would do this. Again, I think what we see here is Nebuchadnezzar uniting his kingdom under one religion. He's got all these different peoples that he's brought together, including the Jews, and he's trying to unite them all together, which may also explain why he's about to get so angry with the three who would not do this. And again, we're going to see that later. If in Revelation, we see the same idea, uniting under a false religion, in that case, Caesar worship. I think there's a lesson here for us. As Christians, of course, we have to remain engaged and involved in our society. We have to be the salt of the earth. You can't be that if you're not part of the society. We have a responsibility to vote. I think we have a responsibility to participate in government. Why? We need to maintain avenues for spreading the gospel. So we need to be involved in those things. But we need to tread very, very carefully when the government wants to get involved with us. That's when we really need to be careful. And when the government wants to use us for its own ends, we need to be very careful. We're going to see more and more of that. I think I mentioned last time that what government cannot do through persecution, government will try to do through embrace, embracing you. And boy, we need to be careful when that starts to happen. When the music started, every person was to fall down and worship the image. Let's look at the musical terms, and the music started. The King James, I mentioned, had cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer. The Revised Standard has horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, and bagpipe. That reminded me of, remember the Far Side cartoon you used to have? I love the Far Side cartoon. The one I remembered when I read that was, they had one that said, "Welcome to heaven, here's your harp. Welcome to hell, here's your bagpipe." So, I don't know. Sorry if there are any bagpipe fans out there, but that's what I thought of when I saw that bagpipe was one of the musical instruments. Cornet or horn, that's the only musical term found here that's found elsewhere in the Old Testament. All the others are peculiar and unique to this discussion. Flute or pipe, as we know what that is, a harp, lyre, comes from a Greek term, kithara, sackbut or trigon, also from a Greek term, psaltery or harp, also from a Greek term. The term translated dulcimer or bagpipe, it may just mean in unison. It may not even be a musical term at all. Others think it may be some kind of a percussion instrument. Now, we discussed this a bit in our introductory class. Verse 5 here lists three Greek words. And the liberal critic has pounced on this, as they used to say, like a duck on a June bug. And they are saying, look, three Greek words, therefore it must have been written in the 2nd century B.C. by someone living in Greek Palestine, etc., etc. And we said in the introduction, that doesn't make any sense. If this had been written in Greek Palestine, you would not have found just three Greek words. You would have found many, many Greek words. And isn't it interesting that these three, the only three Greek words in the book are musical terms? Why? Because musical terms are the very first terms to infiltrate a society from a different language, aren't they? Why? Because the music comes from outside and it brings in the musical terms. We still use Italian terms in our own music books. So it's not surprising at all there would be three Greek words. There are 20 Persian words in this book. Would you have expected 20 Persian words if this book had been written by someone living in the Greek-speaking world in 1670 B.C., at which time the Greeks had been in control of Palestine for 160 years? Would you expect only three Greek words and 20 Persian words? This shows when this book was written. It demonstrates the early date for this book. In verse 6, we finally reach the punitive element of the decree. What happens if you do not fall down and worship the golden image? Well, you get immediately cast into a fiery furnace. These furnaces were used to make the bricks that were used to build Babylon. Each of these bricks bore the name and the image of King Nebuchadnezzar. And if you go to the British Museum, you can see some of these bricks, some of which may have been burned and created in the very same fiery furnace that we're looking at here in chapter 3. Very interesting to think of that. They may have been created in the same fiery furnace in which our three heroes will soon be tossed. The fuel was charcoal, burned at a very high temperature. They found these large brick kilns there. They know what they look like. It would have been enclosed because you had to enclose it to get it up to the right amount of heat. They kind of looked like a railway tunnel that was kind of closed on one end with an entrance on the other end. And they would had these updraft parts so you could even look down from on top if you were standing on top of it. And the temperature could reach 1,000 degrees centigrade. So very, very hot. Death by burning. We actually see Nebuchadnezzar doing that elsewhere in the Bible. Jeremiah 29:22. The Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire. So we know that he did this to others. This has always been the world's message to God's people. Always. Comply or face the consequences. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar is saying here to them. The world still has its fiery furnaces, doesn't it? And it still loves to frighten God's people with them, doesn't it? If you step out of line in our politically correct society, what happens to you? Immediately you will be cast into the fiery furnace. And we're seeing more and more of that. In an earlier lesson, I talked about what I called then Daniel moments. Moments when we all face when we have an opportunity to stand up and be counted as being on God's side. Those opportunities allow us to show our loyalty to God. And they allow us to show our refusal to compromise with this world. And as I've mentioned, as our nation is declining, we're going to get more and more of those opportunities, I think. And we need to pray for them. I think we need to pray that they will come because it's a good opportunity for us to stand up and be counted as on the Lord's side. It can be very tough, as we're going to see here in chapter 3. But when they do come, we need to make sure we choose wisely. I got an email just in the last week or two about some things that are going on and the world at large. Let me read you a few of them. When I use the word Christian in these descriptions, I'm using it in the same sense that I'm just using what was reported to me in the email. I don't know about these people. I assume the word is being used very broadly. But here were some of the things. A Christian photographer in New Mexico was fined $6,700 for declining to photograph a lesbian commitment ceremony. A Christian baker in Oregon is facing both civil and criminal penalties, including jail time, for declining to bake a cake for a gay wedding ceremony. Her business is now closed. A Christian florist in Washington is being sued by the state attorney general for declining to prepare an arrangement for a gay wedding ceremony. Craig James was fired by Fox Sports Southwest after only one day on the job for expressing his support for traditional marriage while he was a candidate for the United States Senate. A student was dismissed from a counseling program at Augusta State University for her religious reservations about the homosexual lifestyle. The Wildflower Inn in Vermont was fined $30,000 and forced to shut down its wedding reception business after declining to host a lesbian ceremony. A student was kicked out of a doctoral program in education at Roosevelt University for expressing in class her belief that homosexuals are not born that way. Now, with many of these, it's going to follow the same pattern we see in Daniel 3. First, they will be given the opportunity to recant, as these three will be given. And these that we just read declined that opportunity. And you can see what happened to them. Into the fiery furnace they went. Very soon, homosexual quote-unquote marriage, it's not marriage because we can't redefine marriage. God defined marriage. But they'll call it marriage. It will soon be legal in every state, including Texas. And that will be within the next year. We can expect increased hostility. We can expect increased pressure. We can expect increased pressure to conform, right? And we can expect increased incredulity when we don't. Just like Nebuchadnezzar. This is history repeating itself. Fortunately, we're not actually being tossed into the actual fiery furnace, but they've got a fiery furnace nonetheless. Romans 12:2, be not conformed to this world. Be not conformed to this world. That verse should be the starting point whenever we're faced with a Daniel moment. Verse 8. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that shall he be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Well, the Chaldeans, in verse 8, clearly resented these certain Jews. Why? Well, we know that why. They'd been set in power over them at the end of chapter 2. And now was the time for revenge, and they were going to get it. They quote the king's edict word for word. Just in case the king had forgotten what he said, let's start by quoting it word for word. And then they inform the king that these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, have paid no heed to the king, no heed to the king's decree. Notice the language they use here. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. King Nebuchadnezzar, this is a personal affront to you, they're saying. They're not regarding you. They're appealing to the king's vanity, of which we know he had a triple dose. The disobedience of these three Jews is a personal affront to King Nebuchadnezzar, made even worse, they would say, by all that the king had done for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Look what he did for them at the end of chapter 2. It's a personal affront to the king. Except for the work of these informers, Nebuchadnezzar would likely never have known about their defiance. So they were informed upon. The world is full of such people that love to create trouble and sit back and watch the fun. But of course, in this case, these Chaldeans had more in mind than just that. They wanted to get these people out of the way. They were resentful and they wanted their revenge. The phrase maliciously accused in verse 8, it literally means eat pieces of the flesh, torn from someone's body. It's an idiom. To consume somebody and rip the flesh from them. That's how much they hated Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and no doubt Daniel as well. We'll talk in a moment about why Daniel isn't on this list. Well, what was their motive? Well, we've mentioned some. They may have just wanted to be troublemakers, but I think they were very jealous here, very jealous. There may have even been some racial animosity against the Jews. Where did Abraham come from? Ur of the what? Chaldees. There was a racial connection going back all the way to Abraham here with the Chaldeans, and there may have been some racial animosity here. Well, why did these three refuse to worship the giant image? Well, that's the easiest question we'll ask all day, right? We know why. We don't have to look any further than the first two commandments to know why. Exodus 23 through 5. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. You wouldn't get past the first two commandments if you fell down and worshiped this false god. Today, we live in an image-obsessed culture, don't we? Image-obsessed culture. One in which the written word is diminishing. It's diminishing. In short, we live in a culture that has seen the movie but has not read the book. And we need to be so much on guard against that. God communicates to us through the Word. How important is the Word to God? Start off reading the Gospel of John, and that'll answer that question. In the beginning was the Word. Word made flesh. We must always exalt the Word over the image, and our society is running in exactly the opposite direction. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do you not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if you be ready, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made. Well, but if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Here it is. You see it all. First, he's just incredulous. How could you not do this? But I'm going to give you a chance to recant. Right now you can do it and all will be well. But if you don't do it, into the fiery furnace. How can you not believe? How can you possibly believe the homosexual lifestyle is wrong? How can you believe that? But I'm going to give you a chance to recant right here, right now. But if you don't, out the door. That's just history repeating itself, right? That's exactly what they're being asked to do here. They did the right thing, we're about to see. The question is, will we do the right thing? But here's an example for us. These three young men, remember, they're still very young. They've still been dragged off from their homeland and into a foreign world, a foreign culture. Their parents were left behind. And here they are. And you see what they do, making a stand for God. What a wonderful example for us. Nebuchadnezzar's response here is exactly what the Chaldeans wanted to see. He's in a furious rage. They had pulled his strings, hadn't they? The great Nebuchadnezzar, we fall down and worship my image when I wave the baton. Well, who's waving the baton now? Right? These Chaldeans are pulling his strings like a puppet. And he's dancing to the tune. The great Nebuchadnezzar thought he was the one who could make people dance or fall down. But who's dancing here? We need to be on guard when anyone's trying to pull our strings, like they're pulling Nebuchadnezzar's strings here. But, you know, there was some concept of justice left in the world, so he did give them an opportunity to recant. But they're not going to do that. Remember where this is all happening, too. I think it's still happening in front of all these foreigners, all these delegates from around the world, all the people that were listed, all the different commanders and things. So there's a lot of people watching what's happening here, and I think that's contributing to Nebuchadnezzar's rage and his fury. But we're going to have to keep that in mind, though, as we move to the end of the chapter, when something else important is going to happen, that all the people that are witnessing this, and that's going to also help us answer the question as to why God saved them from that fiery furnace. Because does God always save us from that fiery furnace? No. But God did save these three. We're going to ask why. Next week, we're also going to ask another big question. Where's Daniel? Next week, we'll continue. Thank you for your attention.